The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic that I had thought of talking about is impermanence, and I noticed that Max also talked about impermanence last week, and sometimes it can be interesting to just hear the perspective, hear on a topic from different perspectives. So instead of changing my topic, I thought I would just talk about impermanence anyway. Fear? Well, the title of the talk was Fear and Impermanence. So maybe he talked, I mean, I can, you know, impermanence opens to fear. So I'll talk about it more from the impermanence side today. So we all do know that things are impermanent. You know, this is not a surprise to us when we talk about it. You ask anybody, you know, do things change? And it's like, well, yeah, of course things change. And yet, the deeper import of that, the real taking into the heart of that truth is not something that we really do. We don't take that in so much. There's a Hindu kind of play almost or a piece of the Mahabharata where one of the characters is reflecting on this very fact. And the translation of this is that this character has been asked, you know, what do you think is the most amazing, most wonderful thing in the world? And this character says, this I think is most wonderful, that people in this world, even though they see before their eyes constantly creatures dying and passing away, never for a moment does the idea enter into them. I too have to fall. I am also a creature destined to be destroyed. Even if it is told to them, it never enters their mind. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into the head. That every person one day must die, yet every person lives as if they were immortal. This is the greatest wonder. You know, impermanence is staring at us in the face every day. Our death in particular is staring at us in the face, and yet we don't truly take it in. So the exploration of impermanence, you know, the Buddha actually pointed to not seeing this truth of impermanence. The Buddha pointed to the fact that only the surface mind understands that we don't deeply take in this truth of impermanence as being one of the main reasons why we suffer. That essentially, you know, all experience is impermanent. There's one scholar who says that the suffering that we have is just but a logical implication of the fact of impermanence. Let's see if I can find that quote. Dukkha, suffering, the Pali word for suffering, dukkha is but a logical corollary arising from the universal law of impermanence. For the impermanent nature of everything can lead to one inescapable conclusion. As everything is impermanent, it cannot be made the basis of permanent happiness. Whatever is transient is by that very fact unsatisfactory. And so we, in our quest for happiness, one of the key ways that we go about this, is by trying to find things, experience, ideas, views that will make us happy. We put our happiness, we put our happiness on a place that is not reliable for happiness, this impermanent, changing experience. We often think of the changing nature of the material world, and often we do try to put our happiness in the material world, but you know, we see that doesn't last too much. You know, that's a pretty obvious place where we see the unsatisfactory nature of putting our happiness in the material world. And so then we look at, well, what does it mean to put our happiness in? Well, how about in our relationships, or in having a satisfying job, or in having people see me the way I'd like to be seen? You know, even those things are impermanent. Relationships end. If they don't end through conflict in the relationship, they will end through one or the other of the parties, of the people dying. Satisfying work. You know, I feel incredibly fortunate to be able to be doing this work. This is like one of the most satisfying kinds of work there is. And yet, you know, the mind could undergo a stroke. You know, the brain could have a stroke, and I might not be able to speak. So even this is impermanent. I don't have control over this. Our opinions of that people have of us, wanting to base our happiness on opinions that people have of us. Well, we can see our own opinions of things and people change. So how reliable is it to base our happiness on the opinions of others? And so this whole way that we orient towards finding happiness, towards finding something reliable to either to construct or to hold on to, it's destined, ultimately destined, to not create that reliable happiness. And so the Buddha pointed to understanding this truth of impermanence as being key to our freedom, which is basically, you know, the key definition that is given for freedom is the releasing of suffering, the releasing of, and the suffering is constructed through these functions in our mind of greed, aversion, and confusion, delusion. And so the releasing of those, the ending of those, is this freedom. And those functions of mind, greed wants to land on something, to hold on to it, to claim it, to own it. It's trying to hold on to something that is impermanent, and it will ultimately not be satisfied. Aversion, too, kind of wants to push something away. It's kind of imputing a kind of a permanence to something by wanting to push it away. And the confusion is around thinking that there is something, that there's something out there that would make me happy. And so this releasing of this view around, kind of this confused view that there's something permanent to be found in our experience, where happiness may be found, as we begin to really deeply see and recognize the impermanent nature of our experience, the mind begins to let go of that habit of trying to hold on, of trying to find something to be happy with that is impermanent. And so the very seeing of the impermanent nature of our experience is a deep corrective for this mistaken notion of mind. And the Buddha encouraged us to, he said, cultivate the perception of impermanence. Begin recognizing that, again, impermanence is staring us in the face. You know, that it's everywhere, but our mind kind of glosses over it And it's only when there's really dramatic kinds of impermanence that we, it kind of shocks us. You know, it's like, whoa, I didn't expect that. There's a poem. This was offered to me by one of our Sangha members. He had found this poem or heard this poem. One of our Sangha members, Victor Medina, who died, actually, so I think two years ago, right at this time. I think he died on July 5th, July 4th or July 5th. So is this appropriate? It's his the anniversary of his death. And he was really deeply facing this truth of his own death, his own impermanence, and this kind of shocking nature of impermanence that we, when there is, like, it's inescapable to us, and we feel somehow like, whoa, I didn't expect this. This poem speaks to that. It's called The Daikini Speaks by Jennifer Wellwood. My friends, let's grow up. Let's stop pretending we don't know the deal here. Or if we truly haven't noticed, let's wake up and notice. It's simple. How could we have missed it for so long? Let's grieve our losses fully, like ripe human beings. But please, let's not be so shocked by them. Let's not act so betrayed, as though life had broken her secret promise to us. Impermanence is life's only promise to us, and she keeps it with ruthless impeccability. To a child, she seems cruel, but she is only wild, and her compassion is exquisitely precise, brilliantly penetrating, luminous with the truth. She strips away the unreal to show us the real. This is the true ride. Let's give ourselves to it. Let's stop making deals for a safe passage. There isn't one anyway, and the cost is too high. We are not children anymore. The true human adult gives everything for what cannot be lost. Let's dance the wild dance of no hope. To me, this speaks to the way in which when we are confronted by impermanence at a very deep level, if we haven't been open to it, if it's been only the surface mind, it's kind of a feeling of shock. We feel betrayed, like we've done something wrong or life has failed us, and it is simply the nature of things. It's a hard lesson, but it is truth. And one of the other ways we can think about the way we suffer or how and why we suffer, is when we are not in alignment with the way things actually are, when our kind of our being is at resistance or at odds with what's actually true, we suffer because of that. And so when we align ourselves with truth, we stop resisting truth. There's a way in which, admittedly, after some work, there's a way in which the system, our system can relax, and it's like, oh, right, this is what's true. This is what's true. Only the surface mind understands the language. The actual sense never goes into the head. So there are different levels which we can cultivate this perception of impermanence. And to me, this instruction by the Buddha, he said to his own son, cultivate the perception of impermanence. And this, to me, brings in the fact that it is staring us in the face and we don't take it in. And so kind of orient to when impermanence happens. It happens all day, every day. But we don't consciously recognize, oh, right, impermanence at work. Oh, impermanence at work. And so there are ways that we can do this through reflection And this is using the surface mind. Reflection is using our surface mind. But when we consciously acknowledge it with this recognition of, oh, right, this is the way things are, it begins to penetrate. It begins to kind of go a little bit deeper. And so we can use reflection as a tool for us. This reflection can be used at a kind of more obvious levels of impermanence, and it can be very supportive to begin to recognize the obvious levels of impermanence. You know, the obvious levels of impermanence are, we see this. We see this at cataclysmic ways. You know, the impermanence of life through, you know, terrorist attacks, which have been so much in the news this last few weeks. We see it through catastrophe in cataclysmic ways, through earthquakes, tsunamis. That tsunami that happened so many years ago, that was stunning. Hundreds of thousands of people dying in the space of a few hours. And it could be us. You know, we're not immune from this. We're not. This is one of the ways the Buddha actually asked us to reflect on impermanence. He suggested that we reflect regularly on impermanence. He suggested we reflect on the fact that we age, that we grow ill, that we die, and that we become separated from things that we love. And in this reflection, he encouraged us to reflect in this way. It's the English translation goes something like, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. And so it's reminding ourselves that, yes, while we may not be, you know, sick or dying in this moment, this is our nature. It's, again, reminding us of that truth that can help to penetrate into our minds. And reminding ourselves when something happens, you know, this, it might be me. It might be me. This doesn't have to be depressing, actually. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Then there's other forms of obvious impermanence that happen in our lives, you know, just living our lives. Friends die, parents, children die. We get a diagnosis of some illness, such as cancer, and things change radically for us. Even if in the moment experience doesn't radically change, the idea, the learning of something like that has a huge impact on us. And then there's subtler levels, you know, the kind of obvious kinds of impermanence that happen. You know, these are the kind that we see, like the changing of the seasons, we see this, but it's a slower kind of change. So it's not as much so obvious. You know, it's like day to day we don't see the leaves coming out, the leaves changing color. Although in the fall in Massachusetts, it does seem day to day. It's so much more in the fall, like a real reminder of impermanence. And if you can remind ourselves of that, all right, this is impermanent. This is impermanent. There's simple ways we can do this. You know, something breaks. We drop a glass, a favorite glass, and impermanence. It was the nature of that glass to break. It's not life conspiring against me. It is just the nature. We can remind ourselves of this truth. Oh, impermanence. This is impermanence happening. Even in our, you know, our just experience. You know, you're sitting here right now, and you were at wherever you were this morning. And so wherever you were this morning, that experience is gone. And here you are now. And this experience will disappear. We don't think of that. We don't recognize that just the very living of our lives is a manifestation of change. Sometimes we can think about it in terms of change. We think about impermanence. We think about things appearing and disappearing. But more, it's really pointing to just this endless flux. And so there's been a flux during the day today. And we can kind of key into that and remember, right, there's change happening. All the time change is happening. As I'm speaking, the words coming out of my mouth are changing. Every moment, there's a new experience. One of the most profound ways to take this in, this truth of impermanence, is actually to do that reflection the Buddha suggested of us around, in particular, death. Bringing this reflection in daily, even. At one point, there's a chant called the Five Subjects for Frequent Recollection. Four of them have to do with impermanence, the four I mentioned. I'm of the nature to age, I'm of the nature to sicken, I'm of the nature to die. All that I have beloved and pleasing will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And the fifth one is a reflection on how our choices in our life influence the consequences. So I'm the owner of my actions. Whatever actions I will do create my future, essentially. So I'll quote it. I'm the owner to my karma. Karma basically meaning action and result of action. I'm the owner of my karma. Heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I do, for good or for ill, of that I'm the heir. Whatever actions I do, whether they're helpful or unhelpful, I reap the consequences. I reap the results of those actions. And so it's pointing to the lawful nature of our experience. Karma is not the subject for the talk today. I could give many talks on karma. Maybe I'll do that next week. Impermanence, reflecting on impermanence daily. At one point I put those reminders on my bathroom mirror and just read them each day. Just reminding myself, right, I'm of the nature to die. This may be my last day on the planet. Just reminding yourself, You may die, your loved ones may die, friends, coworkers, any of them may die before you or after you. We have no idea. This is truly, it is so difficult. I mean, I know this. And I've experienced moments where I deeply know it, where there's just this really deep recognition of I have no idea if I'll be alive in the next split second. And I know this. And yet the delusion keeps coming back. Delusion around this is so potent. And so, you know, my mind, you know, it knows this at the surface, right? But it's not, it doesn't take in this moment. It's like my mind feels like, yeah, I'll come to the end of this talk. Yeah, I'll have my interview after that. And then I have a meeting. Yeah, that's going to happen. I don't know that it's actually going to happen, and I can tell myself that. But the deeper recognition or understanding of that is much harder to touch into. And yet we can remind ourselves of it, and it begins to penetrate. At one point, I'm told, I don't remember where I read this story. It's about Carlos Castaneda. And Carlos Castaneda has some great quotes from Don Juan on impermanence. But this one I'm thinking of is Castaneda's own quote. He was apparently having dinner with some people, and one of the people at that dinner said to him, I'm having trouble really connecting to a spiritual life. And Castaneda is said to have responded, then reflect daily that everyone you love will die in no particular order. You will soon have a spiritual life. It connects us with this truth. And it actually, you know, in some way, it seems paradoxical that reflecting on this would not be depressing. I mean, it feels like it would be. The surface mind thinks, yeah, I don't want to reflect on death. That's just going to make me depressed. I just, you know, when it happens, it'll happen, but I don't want to think about it. And yet, paradoxically, what happens as we start to reflect on it is that we see and we feel into the fact that every human being, every being on our planet shares this same fate. We are all tenuous. We are all these very delicate creatures. And that recognition of that truth kind of breaks the heart and opens it to a compassion for others, for ourselves, that we're all living in this very tenuous world. Another quote. Let's see if I have that one in here. Oh, I guess I don't have this one here. It's something along the lines of, as we see that we are dying and all beings are dying with us, it opens us to a heartbreaking compassion. So it softens our heart. It opens our heart. And in some odd way, too, it creates a kind of delight in what's here in this moment. Kind of the preciousness of this moment, because we don't know how many more we have. And so this reflection on impermanence does not have to be depressing. Another poem. There's so many great poems about this topic. This is pointing to both this reflection on death, but just in general, the suffering of life being something that will open us to this softer heart. This is a poem that's often read, and so you may recognize it, but I don't get tired of hearing it. So hopefully you don't either. It's called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. And so there are these obvious kinds of levels of impermanence that we can reflect on, use our capacity for thinking and reflecting to help it begin to penetrate. And then as we practice, we begin to touch into the more moment-to-moment truth of impermanence, kind of a subtler level of impermanence. And this truth of the moment-to-moment level of impermanence, you know, it's spoken to in physics, you know, the appearance of the solid world is just an appearance. There's nothing that's still or stable at the very bare level, the very kind of basic level of reality. It's all atoms and particles whirling around. We're all atoms and particles whirling around. And so while we can't quite touch into that in the direct moment, we can begin to touch into how our direct experience is changing rapidly from moment to moment. Through our meditation practice, we can begin to touch into this. We can see this. We can experience it. We can start to experience it in more obvious ways by, again, using our reflective capacity to recognize or remember, okay, this state of mind that I'm in right now, you know, we can just kind of watch our states of mind, our moods, our emotions kind of fluctuate through the day. Sometimes we get caught in them and they, you know, they kind of land for a while, but, you know, we watch and we see they're changing. We can see our thoughts change incessantly. It's like this endless tumble of thoughts. Our body sensations change. As we're on retreat, we can start to really get curious about this piece, or as we're sitting in meditation, we can get curious about this piece, about our moment-to-moment experience changing. We can turn our attention to the breath and notice the sensations that make up the breath. Well, first of all, just that there's an in-breath and an out-breath. Every breath is different. You know, at the end of our life, there will be a final out-breath. And we can kind of use that to recognize, okay, this in-breath, this out-breath, will there be another in-breath? Oh, there is another in-breath. It's a new in-breath. We can see that directly. We can start to see our minds. At one point on a retreat, I was kind of getting interested in my moods and my states of mind, and many of them had been kind of landing and staying around for hours. You know, so I'd get angry. Something would crop up in my mind, would turn angry, and I would watch it, and I would practice with it, and I would see it, and you know, so they were landing for stretches of time. And then one morning, as I was doing my yogi job, I was cleaning pots. I picked up one pot and I was angry at the pot. You have to be scraped. I was like, oh, okay, wow, anger, okay. And so I noticed the anger and I scraped the pot and there's anger. And then I put down the pot and I picked up the next pot and there was joy. I was like, what? It was shocking. Because my mind had kind of imputed this sense of, oh yeah, emotions come and they stay for a while. But in this case, the mind was just more interested in, oh, this is what anger's like. And then it vanished, and another state was there. So again, we can kind of take in at a more subtle level this changing nature of experience. So we start to see through, you know, there's the subtler level of change is masked. It's masked by a couple of different pieces. One is that it's masked by how fast things are changing. And this, there's an analogy in the suttas, or maybe not be the suttas, it might be the commentaries. There's an analogy about how impermanence, the fast changing nature of impermanence, creates the illusion of solidity. And well, it's a good day to talk about this since yesterday was the 4th of July. We have a fire stick, and you know, I used to do this when I was a kid with sparklers. And I, you know, wave them around and watch how it created lines in the air. And you can whirl it fast enough and it looks like a circle. So the rapid change of that creates the illusion of something more persistent. So that's one way that impermanence is kind of hidden from us, because things are changing so rapidly. As we meditate, we can begin to kind of get underneath, to some degree, we can begin to get underneath this rapid change. This can be kind of a surprise for us in certain areas, like pain, for instance. You know, we look at feeling, we feel pain, we feel an experience of pain, and it feels like it's a solid mass. And that solid mass is, you know, it's changing very quickly. But we don't see it as changing quickly. We kind of attribute or have this, because it's changing quickly and partly because of an idea, it feels like something solid. And so if we can begin to be non-averse to the experience of the pain, we can start to kind of be curious about, okay, well, what is the actual experience of what I'm calling this block of pain? My knee hurts, you know. It's like, okay, the whole knee. It's like the pain is like this big, like grapefruit-sized thing, and it's solid. And if there cannot be so much pushing away of it, and you just land in that experience, you see actually there's a wide variety of sensations of pulling, of twisting, of burning, of sparking, of things appearing and disappearing, of sensations rapidly appearing and disappearing. And partly the aversion has kind of, we've tried to push it away, and it created this kind of barrier to it, and that very pushing away creates a kind of solidity. So both the rapid change, rapid nature of change, and our idea have both conspired to make us believe that it's solid. And so we can kind of be curious about what is our actual experience. When we're thinking things are solid, when we take something to be solid or really stable, it's interesting in our meditation to, okay, well, that seems solid. Let's pay attention to it and see what happens. As you start to pay attention to it, you will notice maybe some subtle fluctuations, maybe some more obvious fluctuations. You may see, as I did, something vanishing really quickly that I had the idea of, this is going to last a long time, and poof, it's gone in a split second. This begins to have this truth of impermanence go much more deeply into our being. So the rapidity of change masks impermanence. And also concepts. You know, I said the idea of pain is something that also kind of holds it into place. So ideas create a sense of solidity. Actually, concepts is what we relate to so much of our life through concepts. And those concepts come with a lot of ideas and views and baggage. And when we relate to experience through concept, it's much harder to notice that things are changing around that concept. So even something as simple as a chair, you know, looking at a chair. Now I look at the chair and it's like, yeah, there's a chair there. You know, it's like, it's solid, it's stable, it's a thing. Yet most of my, that chair, for instance, the entirety of my experience of that chair has to do with the sight and the idea of chair. And as I move, you know, even moving this way to that way, you know, the chair changes. The visual field changes. But in my mind, when I'm relating to it as concept, the chair doesn't change. And so this notion of the stability of chair partly comes about through the fact that we're relating to it as an idea. In, you know, as babies, I think, and you know, we're seeing these kind of dynamically changing visual fields. Like on the retina here, that is not at all stable, even as I move from side to side. And yet the mind creates the stability. The concept creates the stability. This is not a problem. This is actually useful that concepts create stability for us to relate to the world. You know, if I had to recreate what's in this room second by second, that would take so many brain cycles. It would be exhausting. And so the use of concepts is a shortcut for us to be able to navigate our world. And yet what we miss is that we take our concepts to be reality. I think I talked about this a few weeks ago. You know, we take our concepts, our ideas to be reality, and we don't see that there's so much room for error, including imputing permanence. One of the major errors we have around concepts. We impute permanence to things with concepts. Do I have time for this story? Let me see. What else do I have? I think I do have time for this story. So I had one. There's an exhibit at the Exploratorium that kind of points out how the mind creates solidity out of just changing blips of information. And seeing this, it really is quite stunning to recognize that that level of creation is going on in our minds most of the time. And that what we're relating to in our world isn't the world itself, but it's actually something constructed by our minds. So this Exploratorium exhibit, I went with my nephew probably some 25 years ago. It's a long ago exhibit. I don't know if they still have it at the Exploratorium. But we walked into the Exploratorium, and I noticed, kind of hanging at the back of the room, were these long bars. They were hanging from the ceiling. They were probably 6 feet long, maybe longer. They were spaced about every 4 or 5 feet. And they had flashing lights on them. That's all I saw about that. It's just like, huh, I wonder what that's about. I'll have to check that out later. And so, you know, there's just these bars hanging on the ceiling with these flashing lights. And then I didn't think much about it, and my nephew and I were sitting down having a snack or something, and he's looking up at those bars, and he suddenly said, "It's a school bus!" And I looked up at the bars, and I saw flashing lights, and I said, "What?" He said, "Now it's butterflies!" What are you talking about? And so I started exploring. It's like, okay, I'm going to see what is happening here. What is he seeing, you know? And so I began just kind of looking, relaxing my eyes and looking at the field of the flashing lights. And lo and behold, with the eyes moving in a particular way, the bars became, so they're spaced, they're just like, they're rods, you know, they're just rods, and they're spaced about 4 feet apart. But what happened in the visual field was that there was a screen that was created, kind of a movie screen was created in the air. And across that screen, I saw driving a school bus. It was such a detailed image, I could read the name of the school district on the side of the school bus. It was very clear to me that this was created in the mind. This was not physically happening up there, but the impression was so fully out there that there was a screen. It was created by these little blips of light, and my understanding is like, you know, it's like each bar is flashing the lights as if, you know, if you had a wooden fence with slats in it, and something were driving by on the other side, you get a little piece of that. And so it's like that's what was showing on those bars, which is these little blips of what that image would be if it were going past a fence. And the mind, through something I think is called persistence of vision, you know, carries the image from one bar to the next, and it picks up on the next bar. It's quite amazing how our minds create solidity out of nothing, out of blips of light. And this happens all the time. And so this kind of seeing this, or at least reflecting on the nature of our minds to construct and create concepts, ideas, and to create solidity. You know, it's almost a function of our minds that it wants to create solidity through concepts because it is so useful. And so it's not that we're trying to get rid of that, but we're trying to recognize and see through that solidity as being actual, real solidity. Because it is that misunderstanding that it is real solidity is one of the causes for us to think, oh, that's what will make me happy, to land on that and then find ourselves suffering when it falls apart. So this deeper seeing of impermanence, this kind of recognition of the kind of moment-to-moment nature of impermanence, again, just checking into your experience, what do you think is solid? You know, the sensations right now of your hands touching each other, you know, or your hands touching your legs or wherever they are. You know, just what's the actual sensations of that? You might kind of just drop into what's really there. Let go of the idea of hand right now. Feel into pulsing, tingling, vibrating. It's almost like it's just this field of sensations hovering in air. There can be hardness or stiffness. If you're just experiencing the feeling, and let go of the idea of hand. And now look at your hand. Think about it as a hand. You know, it's like, where does that sensation go? You know, I still kind of feel it, but the idea of hand can kind of mask that more subtle, changing experience. And to close, another quote. This is from a book called A Walk in the Woods by Kantipalo. Everything and everyone, that includes you and me, deteriorates, ages, decays, breaks up, and passes away. And we, living in the forest of desires, are entirely composed of the impermanent. Yet our desire impels us not to see this, though impermanence stares us in the face from every single thing around. And it confronts us when we look within, mind and body arising and passing away. So don't turn on the TV, go to the pictures, read a book, see some food, or 100 other distractions just to avoid seeing this. This is the one thing really worth seeing, for one who fully sees it is free. We do distract ourselves from impermanence. And so this reflection the Buddha offered, cultivate the perception of impermanence, helps us to open to this truth at a deeper level. So, comments? Questions? There's a few minutes if there's any. Yeah. And would you use the mic? And there's a switch on the side. Button, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's on now. This has been helpful for me working through a concept that I found difficult to understand, but I feel like I'm not all the way there, which is the relationship between impermanence and illusion and non-existence.
Mm.
So I've done reading where there's kind of an A to C logic. Once you recognize the impermanence, you'll realize it's not really real. It's an illusion.
It's an illusion. It's an odd use of the word illusion, though. Here's what I would say about that. So, for instance, here I am looking out at you. At a level, I know, I understand. I would say I'm not experiencing this directly in this moment, but I know for a fact, for truth, that all I know of what's happening is created in my mind. That's all I can experience, is that creation in my mind. There's sights hitting the retina. The mind creates the concepts of what's out there. I think there's something out there. I don't think you're illusion. I don't think you're a figment of my imagination. But what I can know is created by my mind. And so all that we can know is this. In a way, it's an illusion. It's a magic show in our minds. It's a creation. It's a reflection of what's out there. It's not what's actually out there. And so, you know, the part of the thing we have to recognize is that because all that we can know is created by our minds, there's a huge avenue for error to slip in. And one of the main errors we have is this belief that, oh yeah, things are permanent. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that it's, for me at least, there are certain schools that believe everything is created by mind, that I don't know how they feel about reality. but, you know, I think there is a reality that's being reflected. And the Buddha really pointed to, actually my understanding of what the Buddha was pointing to was this impermanent nature of our experience, and that undercutting the belief in the permanent nature of experience is where happiness can be found. And that, you know, I don't know that the Buddha cared so much about or was interested so much in whether, you know, reality was permanent, although he did talk about this kind of, you know, the big picture. They have a cosmology that's very like a Big Bang kind of expansion contraction, and it's like, you know, he talks about that. It's like, yeah, Earth is going to go away, you know. So to that extent, there is a kind of a teaching on the ultimate impermanent nature of everything. But really, where the suffering arises is in our minds around the attribution of permanence to this. To this experience. So that's how I would talk about it.
Yeah. What occurs to me is that if the nature of your existence is mostly due to a creation in my mind, and my mind...
Your experience of my existence.
Yeah. My mind and I am impermanent, then what I'm experiencing is you... goes away.
That's right.
Once I'm gone.
That's right.
So impermanence in some ways ensures that you only exist in that moment that I experience you.
Your experience of me exists in that moment. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you walk out this door, I cease to exist for you, actually. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of mind-boggling. And we need to stop. So thank you for your attention.